The point is not to bet on tail events. The whole idea of the black swan, everything. I've been telling everyone, every person I meet.
Is to bet on disruption, on unforeseen.
To not be harmed by silent risk.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's the idea. The first thing is don't be harmed by it.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, you know, given that when we study tail events, you say these people are ignoring these risks, so therefore their risk in the system that people generate and don't see.
Mm-hmm.
Hence, you can trade on it. You always look at how people have lost money, because when you read the you know reports and stories, they hide the losses because nobody's going to write a book on how they lost all this money. Mm-hmm. And it's always invariably the same. The world's getting bigger and bigger and bigger, but it's like a large movie theater with the same door. You see, it's the size of the door that matters when you want to get out, not the size of the theater. So the supply chain is narrow.
Mm-hmm.
It's gotten narrower. Now probably will expand and branch out and will have a better networks. But people will not understand that. This is why people like to sell tail events, because it costs money. We have noticed very early on in the 90s a phenomenon that international diversification was no longer diversification.
Hmm.
Convexity is if you make more, if the market goes down 10%, you make $1 million. If it goes down 20%, you make $10 million, you have convexity.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what everything is based on. Well, that general idea. Like,
yeah,
they would call it convex.
Mm-hmm.
And concave, probably the best illustration is how we fared in 2007. And I explained it in the Black Swan, right before it happened.
Mm-hmm.
I looked at the risk of Fannie Mae by a deserter who, you know, left Fannie Mae and distributed the risk reports. Okay. Mm-hmm. We looked at the risk of Fannie Mae and noticed that if the market, say, an interest rate or risk or mortgage premium or something like that is increased by 100 basis points, they lost X. 200 basis points, 20 times X.
Mm-hmm.
300 basis points, I said, they're sitting on a barrel of dynamite in the Black Swan.
Mm-hmm.
2007, 5 months later, okay, they started going on and eventually they lost. They booked $600 billion losses, okay? While they said, oh, they reacted to me by saying, oh, we monitor our risk, we have 15 PhDs, okay? 15 PhDs, 15 trillion PhDs. It's not going to help you with this. So this is convexity on the losses, and we're doing the reverse on the profit side.
Mm-hmm.
And there have been a lot of people get upset the way Mark presents the numbers. He writes, to his investors, you know, you file with the SEC, all the numbers are available. They tell them, listen, we made 4,000% on your maximum loss.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Whereas if you invest in the S&P, you can lose 100% of what you have.
Mm-hmm.
So the return you have on that maximum possible potential loss. Yeah. In other words, when you go to bed in the evening, all you could lose is that much, and how much these options were explosive on their maximum loss. Right?
Yeah.
So that was
the asymmetrical.
That was the asymmetry, the 4,000 some percent. But that's not the first time it happened. Nobody noticed. Before the crisis of 1987, there was a Plaza Accord where a bunch of people got together secretly on a Sunday and made an announcement, we're going to support the currencies against the dollar is too expensive. We had a huge move. I was at work, we had a tiny risk. An explosion of my P&L. Okay, they brought detectives or inspectors to figure out why the P&L is so large for that so little risk.
Mm.
Because you had your maximum risk, all you could lose is say X $1,000, and the P&L exploded. Mm. So that's how it works. They couldn't believe it, right? So I decided, okay, I'm going to make a living.
Now, when you say exploded, this is in a bad way or a good way?
Good
way. Yeah. I see the P&L.
Yeah. Yes, the P&L was too large for the risk. Say we're supposed to only take.
You said your computers couldn't handle the numbers. Right.
Yeah, no.
So for them, it's like it's high risk, high reward. How are you getting low risk, high reward?
No, no. They said you made too much money. You got to be taking risk. You're hiding something from us.
That's what I mean.
And the computers would take something like 10 hours at a time to compute the P&L at the end of the P&L.
Mm-hmm.
You see, so every time they said, go redo it and stuff like that. And I was frustrated because they couldn't understand it. They couldn't understand it. But this is the same thing happened to Mark.
This is the trade that they did for, you know, that's the beginning of the trade that became Empirica Universa. Something like, I remember when I was talking to Mark back in 2008, he would never tell me this now, but I was trying to figure out how they had such incredible returns.
Mm-hmm.
And he gave me an example of a trade that they made. And it was, I forget the timing, but it was like a July 2008 S&P 500 put option, betting on a 20% decline in the S&P 500, bought for $2. After the crash, he sold it for $60. That's the kind of convex exponential return that you do not get in any other kind of trading. And you just, you take that $2 option, you magnify it over millions and millions of dollars, you get 4,000% return.
Yeah, but if they're even more dramatic than $2 becoming $60, you always look at how people have lost money, because when you read the, you know, reports and stories, they hide the losses because nobody's going to write a book on how they lost all this money. Mm-hmm. And it's always invariably the same. There was a story of volume investors, I think, they're selling out of the money options on gold, and they're selling for 5 cents and end up have to buy them for $40. And then there's a Niederhofer story, same story, where he liquidated, and when he blew up, I mean, he blew up many times, but one time it broke, you can see the prices. He sold them for 5-10 cents, and then he had to buy them back, and I was buying them back to $40. That's what I noticed.
With selling volatility.
Selling out of the money, tails, selling rare events, and you don't need a large deviation, just people panic, they pay anything, because, or sometimes they're forced to, because the clearing houses or counterparties cannot handle the risk. They say, I'm going to close you out, sorry. And you close out, hey, there's no liquidity. It's like the famous saying, sell everything. And then the clerk, I told you sell everything, why are you not moving? He said, please tell me, to whom, sir?
I want to say Soros is also known as the man who broke the Bank of England, right? Or the British pound. So one of my questions is, in this increasingly interconnected world where the equivalent of the Black Plague, whatever that might be, and it could be in pandemic form or otherwise, instead of taking 300 years is over a weekend in terms of spread, and things are so interdependent, is there the temptation and the risk of investors catalyzing more crises? And I'm wondering if investors will be able to do more damage as the world becomes more interconnected. May not be a good question. I'm just curious. No,
it is an excellent question. Do you want to answer it?
I think that it's possible. I see the damage coming from, you know, negligence and bad risk taking that ends up, you know, creating a contagion effect. Just the same thing that we saw in,
not among investors, but like in the banking.
Yeah, banking or hedge funds or crypto. You know, I think that financial markets over the past 20 years, and increasingly with electronic trading, are more and more interconnected than ever. And this is something I got in my second book about high frequency trading, is how you could see the potential risk of some giant move in, say, a derivative contract or an index, something overseas, because trading machines are correlating all these assets globally, electronically, at hyperspeeds, microsecond speeds, that you could see something move very rapidly into all sorts of asset classes in a way that is impossible to stop because it's so fast. That could be triggered by a trader, or it could be triggered by a computer just going bananas.
We have noticed very early on in the 90s a phenomenon that international diversification was no longer diversification. Why? Because of that integration. Globalization did a lot of good things, pulled people out of poverty. But a lot of things happened with it. Number one, you can't diversify anymore because the stocks collapse here, as we saw in 87, collapse everywhere for large deviation, and now for mild deviation starting in the 1990s. And also, I mean, the funding disappears everywhere, or comes everywhere. So this property of globalization is similar to the one that came with it, that like we're going to have shortages. And then gluts. Now we're in a phase of in between shortage and glut. But shortages can be very deep, where containers go up 10 times, I mean, container shipping, container, and you're going to have a lot of the reverse happening, because I've never seen shortages without gluts. I've seen gluts without shortages, but never shortages without glut. But they're very deep. We didn't have that before. We all depend on the world's getting bigger and bigger and bigger, but it's like a large movie theater with the same door. You see, it's the size of the door that matters when you want to get out, not the size of the theater. So the supply chain is narrow. It's gotten narrower. Now probably it will expand and branch out and will have a better network. But people will not understand that. This is why people like to sell tail events, because it costs money to diversify your sources of, you know, whatever, and your supply. And it also costs money to hedge tail risk, or you think it costs money. You know, you have the illusion. And sure enough, you realize that if a hedge is expensive, you know, think of absence of hedge. How much more expensive it is.
So what's your perspective on the capacity of investors to catalyze greater risk? Not necessarily the systemic risk-taking, although this is certainly a factor of, say, the banking sector or fill in the blank, but very well-funded investors who are looking for black swan or black swan-like opportunities, their ability to create a self-fulfilling prophecy in a sense.
Okay, as I say, predictions are self...
And I'm probably not wording that well as I should.
But as I say, predictions are self-fulfilling and they're also self-canceling. See, early on, the self-fulfilling, people get on that bandwagon. And then sure enough, you know, that's how sort of the glut takes place after the shortage. But one thing, you know, that's quite, one should realize with the structure of the world in which we live, is that although history is not an indicator for many things, because we live in times of different connectivity and stuff like that, the rules of what can go wrong are very simple. You see? One thing, you know, about our previous conversation, when you say the banking sector, the banking sector is very safe for one reason. It's a utility. With high-paid bankers living around here, you see, have big Soho lofts, $10 million Soho lofts, basically, your utility. Because they don't let it go under. It's when it's not the one you got to worry about. It's the saving it, again, that you have to worry about. The effect of saving it. Like, we saved it in 2008 with what? The government debt. And it exploded. And then again, in 2020, they bought so much commercial paper, so many things. Again, all these things aimed at saving the financial system, bank-wise, have spillover effects. But we're going to save the bank system, because you cannot operate without it. Plus, another thing has happened, is that banks used to take a lot of risk. Since 2008, risk has migrated from banks to hedge funds. Now, it's less concentrated, but it still can be concentrated.
In what way can that be concentrated?
In other words, he has a friend who has a big fund that's larger than a lot of banks.
Yeah.
You see?
You mean Citadel?
I'm not mentioning names, right? So you have a lot of big hedge funds, you know, and big hedge, but I guess they can be diversified. Hedge funds have skin in the game. In other words, the owner of the hedge fund has money in it, unlike a bank where you just have the upside, not the downside.
Of course, long-term capital management is the counterexample.
No, it
they
is.
They had skin of the game.
Okay, so there's two things.
Became very systemic.
No, it is. People, the skin in the game is a disincentive, of course, but it also, skin in the game is a filter, you see? So where are the people from? Is anybody from long-term capital management still around?
Last I heard, John Merriweather was 10 years ago trying to start a hedge fund. But
there you go. So, so if you can't recover, the skin in the game has fallen effect. The reason you don't see too many crazy drivers is because they're dead. Because you inflict risk on others, but you experience the same risk. So you tend to exit the pool.
So it seems then, maybe I'm misunderstanding, but that the migration of risk taking to the hedge funds, assuming that the GPs or the people running the fund have sufficient skin in the game, would seem to be a net positive.
Yeah, hedge funds are okay, but we have had the risky part, the ones that are most fragile, the private equity, and of course, by far, people who need funding. Because I don't know if you realize, but since we had our three bottles of champagne, pink champagne, four bottles, whatever, a lot of pink champagne to celebrate Lehman's departure from this town. Since then, we put interest rates at close to zero. So when I was, a student and everything, for me, an investment was something that generates cash flow. So you build something that generates cash flow. So you value cash flow and or residual value at the end. Okay. And that, so you can tolerate negative cash flow if you're going to get some later on. Or if, so it's like us, if you discover gold later on, so the business model was cash flow based with a short term or long term cash flow. The world has changed. All right. In the funding world, what is the game now is who you're going to sell your company to.
I see. So you're talking about startups in this case?
Exactly. Startups or a lot of investments. You buy an apartment, you buy a house, you buy a building, you buy something, or you invest in some crazy idea. And someone was contacting me about LLM models, ChatGPT, by saying, we have this startup, I'm investing in this startup. And looked at the rationale, and then he said, I'd be able to sell it in within 2 years. I said, listen, this is a trap, okay? So companies, say even Twitter was operating on a following modus. We go to the market, okay, as a cash machine. So you don't even have to generate cash. So basically everything came from, it has Ponzi characteristics. Someone else will buy our company, or we're packaging a company to sell it to someone else.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now, that started before the great financial crisis, but it was very moderate. Of course, it took place during the crazy period of the internet bubble and then died. So we had episodes of that effect. But now it's ingrained in people have now for 15 years of low interest rates. You have people in their 40s. I've never seen interest rates. And they don't know how to behave. They don't know how to invest. So I think the most fragile part today is not the banks, of course, as we said. And it's not hedge fund, because it's sort of like mature adults, typically. It is those startups and VCs and venture capitalists. But venture capitalists actually played quite a nasty game, because they cashed out. All of them are rich on companies. They never made a penny.
Hmm.
You see, I know there's a lot of, take how many billionaires you have in Silicon Valley,
mm-hmm.
right? Who ever made a penny? It's valuation, maybe, as I say.
Yeah, there's a lot to that game. I will say also, I think there are going to be tremendous, just fatalities in the next probably three quarters in the startup world, because there's been a lot of contraction of funding, which I think is ultimately probably a good thing. But a lot of these companies are raised.
It's a necessary thing.
Yeah, no. Right. I mean, it's culling of the herd. So I think we're going to see a lot of.
But think about it. This will finally get waiters. Because we have shortage of waiters. Okay, we finally will get waiters. I mean, you go to restaurants and, they have one waiter for the whole room. And so we'll get more waiters, we'll get more people who, will help you mow the grass and stuff. I mean, we've got a lot of supply.
former startup founders serving you your Negroni. We'll see how it shakes out. I'm curious to see.
The genius of Universa is that they managed to package a product as insurance that allows the investors to increase their exposure to the market.
So
the strategy in and by itself is positive, huge return. What's more interesting is that it was hedging something that went up. What did the stock market do since then? I mean, it went up like
30%.
No. In total, since, say, 2007.
Oh, since 2007, yeah. Tripled.
Yeah, it went up. Say twofold, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
So you it allowed people to have a larger position, larger exposure to the market than they would otherwise.
Right.
And also there's a cocktail of other strategies that definitely didn't fare well because they entail diversification away from stocks. So this one allows you to have stocks. So it's very weird because Mark is always bearish on the market, but he provides people a product that couples very well with a very long stock position.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the secret. So given that it's packaged that way, investors tolerated some drawdown, not too much, on the insurance. You see, while looking at it, you got to look at the insurance versus the insured premium.
Yeah.
Exactly. Versus the insured. Hey, this is my differential P&L. And it's the same thing when I started trading options, you have an option hedged by stock. And sometimes people only look at the stock performance, and some people only have the option performance. And tell them, no, it's inseparable. Mm-hmm. You see, this is called the delta, right? So that was how they manage. But the other trick is that you have to understand that we are one trick, or me intellectually, I'm a one trick pony. I think of nothing else but the tail risk. Everything's packaged around tail risk that I do intellectually. But Universal is a one trick pony, only does one trade.
Mm-hmm.
So if you do only one trade, and for a couple of decades, believe me, you know the tricks, right? You know how much to put on, not too much, not too much. You see the idea. If you do just one trade, and then people come to the universe and say, no, that's what we do. We don't do so. Won't you do this for us? No. It's like you're making Maseratis, right? And someone comes to you and say, hey, won't you make trucks? We don't do trucks. When we make bicycle, we don't do bicycle. All we make is one single item. That's it. One single size. One single. And that is the main criticism by others. Hey, the one trick ponies. And that's what we're proud about.
That's the selling point.
Is that we are one trick ponies. And whether in my work intellectually was worried about tail risk, or whether the implementation of Universal, of their ideas, you know, of Mark's ideas, one thing, just one single thing. So when you do one thing professionally,